From the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA, it's Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin. If you have a medical question, call us at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255. Email sundayhousecall at cfra.com. Now here's Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good afternoon and welcome to edition number 436 for this April the 14th, 2013. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin and you are listening to Sunday House Call. I'll be taking your calls at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. Looking forward to speaking with you today. If you have any questions, comments, things that you've seen in the news, I'd be more than happy to discuss these issues with you. And one of those issues was from the Globe and Mail this weekend. And I have to thank my colleague, Dr. Yoni Friedhoff, who posted this on his website, his blog called weightymatters.ca, where he cited this link to the Globe and Mail. It was an op-ed piece written by Dr. Arya Sharma. He's an expert advisor with evidencenetwork.ca and professor and chair in obesity at the University of Alberta and scientific director of the Canadian Obesity Network. And he was commenting on that news story you might have heard about where Samoan Airlines announced that it would begin charging passengers by the pound. Their reasoning being is that as an airline, it costs more. The more a plane is weighed down, the more it costs in fuel costs, which account up to 50% of the cost of the operations of the plane. It costs more if the plane weighs more, which is why people are charged for luggage now if the luggage exceeds a certain capacity. And what they're saying here is being borne out by a comment made by Bharat Bada, an economist from Norway, who suggested that heavier passengers pay a surcharge while lighter passengers are offered discounts. And so, he makes a few comments and gives some examples of his take on this. And so he says here, the logical argument, of course, is that larger individuals take up more space and use up more jet fuel. This line of reasoning is sure to find ample supporters as people who choose, open quote, close quote, choose to be fat must clearly bear the consequences of their gluttony and sloth. But why stop at the airline travel? There are some additional ideas for where businesses could charge larger individuals more. And obviously he's being quite sarcastic in this, but here are his examples. Cab rides. This is not just to cover additional fuel costs, but also to pay for wearing out the suspensions. Two, hotel rooms. Not only will this cover the mattress surcharge, but also cover the cost of the increased consumption of water, soap, and extra towel required to service the greater body surface. Three, gym memberships to cover the additional wear and tear on the treadmills and other exercise equipment. Four, amusement park rides to pay for taking up more space, using more electricity, and taking longer to load and offload. And five, sporting events for occupying an extra seat and obstructing the view. He also goes on to say, why not add all of these to the list of things that obese people are already paying more for, like health and life insurance, oversized clothing, bigger cars, and sturdier home furniture? He goes on and says, that will certainly teach them to finally see the light and begin shedding those pounds. But wait, did anyone mention that obesity rates are already markedly higher in poor income neighborhoods? And that being obese already reduces an individual's chances of employment and promotion despite ability? The assumption underlying the pay-as-you-weigh pricing strategies is that body size is a matter of choice and responsibility. Unfortunately for most, this is not the case. Let me state it clearly. Obesity is not simply a matter of laziness, overindulgence, or lack of willpower. It is the result of complex and diverse drivers of weight gain, including genetics, medications, stress, depression, addictions, eating and sleeping disorders, and gut bugs, to name just a few. The fact that obesity is far less under individual control than generally assumed is further evident from the fact that fewer than 1 in 20 individuals embarking on a weight loss attempt are likely to keep any of the weight off. The jury is still out on whether such failed attempts at weight loss are detrimental to health. They certainly are to the ego. So his again, his contention is that, and I want to get your opinion about this, if you wish to talk about this, is what do you think about this policy? Do you think this is a fair policy, given what Dr. Sharma is saying regarding the multiple factors that contribute to obesity? And he also says there's some dangers in doing this. He says there could be a number of unintended consequences of such a pay-as-you-weigh policy, such as people starving themselves and abusing diuretics, laxatives, and anorexic agents, including tobacco, to lose weight prior to boarding a flight. Such unhealthy weight control practices are already widespread amongst competitive athletes who participate in sports that involve weight categories, such as boxers and wrestlers. This could be life-threatening when it involves patients who are on medications for blood pressure or diabetes, where even short-term attempts at weight loss can result in increased health risks such as stroke and hypoglycemic shock, for example. A single emergency landing because of a diabetic patient skipping breakfast before weighing in for a flight would by far outweigh any potential savings to the airline, not to mention the inconvenience to the other passengers. So what do you think about that? Do you think that this is a issue of fairness based on weight? Do you think this is singling out a group of people that have historically been singled out and treated quite unfairly over time? And he finally says that if airlines wish to treat their passengers like cargo, then a pay-as-you-weigh policy may appear justifiable. But if an airline sees itself as providing a service, namely transporting human passengers, then the average price of a ticket and the average size of a seat should increase. This is the only fair distribution of costs and the only fair way to accommodate everyone. Playing a game of blame and shame is not a constructive solution to the obesity problem. So if you have any comments about that, I'd like to hear what you have to say about it. There were a lot of comments on the Globe and Mail site. Many were critical of this particular article, citing, well, some of them were quite mean-spirited. You know how sometimes you get the trolls that come on and make really unfair and hurtful comments without moving the conversation forward. So you have to sort of filter that out. But the gist of it was based on that issue of fairness. Is this a fair policy, or is this singling out a group of individuals who have a condition that may be due to medical problems and not necessarily one of what we call willpower? And Dr. Friedhoff has talked about this many times, about willpower and how it's not really a question of willpower, because again, the data shows that despite people's best efforts to try to lose weight, it's not that easy to do. People do succeed, and looking at the data, it's about 1 in 20. So you will have people that say, I lost weight. You know, 5 people out of every 100 will say that. But for the vast majority of them, it's a continued struggle. And so it's not the knee-jerk response to say, oh, you know, just stop eating. You know, and I know that it is not that simple, given the environment that we find ourselves, and that there is a reason why we are seeing more and more people gaining weight over time. And it's just not—it's not just a black and white, you know, go from point A to point B type of problem. So if you have any comments about that, I'd be more than happy to listen to what you have to say about it. As I said, it is somewhat contentious. I don't know if any of the airlines are going to be looking at that here, but there is certainly one already in the world that is doing that. And any other questions that you might have, 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You are listening to Sunday House Call, and we'll be back with your calls in just a few minutes.
I joined a health club. I went one time. They always have a big giant guy showing you around.
Oh, you're thinking of joining? Here, follow this guy. Hey, how you doing? Come with me. You know,
I think the guy was messing with me. I think he was making up muscle names. This machine right here is for your flactoid.
Exactly why I'm here.
What about the thing they sell called the step? That thing amazes me. Not the ones that move, the one that you just step on it, step off. People are buying those. People are like sending away for them in the mail, you know? My step is coming in the mail today. You can't find a step somewhere in a house? wrong? It's here. And they run down the steps and get it. This is going to be great.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA.
Talk 521-8255 star 580 on Bell Mobility. 1-800-580-2372 is the number to call. We have lots of lines available, and we're going to line one. And good afternoon to Beverly in Canada.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. My question is about joint replacements.
Yes.
I've had both knees done,
mm-hmm.
and it's regarding the antibiotic dose that I take before I go to the dentist.
Yes.
Now, my dentist thinks 2 years is okay. My surgeon says no forever. So I wanted to get your opinion on it and why we take them in the first place and what's magical about a 2 year.
That's an excellent question, Beverly. The reason for taking antibiotic prophylaxis is that when you operate, if there's surgery that's done on the mouth, because the mouth has many different strains of bacteria, there is a particular strain that if it does get into the bloodstream, it can tend to land or seed on areas where you have these artificial surfaces. So, for example, if the knee with the knee replacement and the joint surfaces, the metal and the plastic that's in there, if the bacteria lands on there, it can grow and cause an infection. The difficulty is trying to treat those infections afterwards is extremely difficult because there's no blood supply that gets to that area of the joint because it's metal and plastic. There's no blood vessels or any way for the antibiotic to get there. So it becomes a very difficult proposition, and sometimes you have to have a more invasive treatment in order to get rid of that infection. So using an antibiotic, usually it's one dose before the procedure, kills off that bacteria if it happens to get into the bloodstream and prevents that kind of infection. It's very similar to people who have artificial heart valves and they go for surgery, oral surgery. They have to take an antibiotic prior to the surgery for exactly the same reason, because if you get bacteria that land on, say, an artificial valve or even a replacement valve, which isn't necessarily made of metal or plastic, if it lands on those valves, it can cause what's called a bacterial endocarditis, which is a very difficult infection to clear up. The question of whether you do that for 2 years or for forever is based on two different camps, right? The orthopedic surgeons want no risk at all over a person's lifetime. Those people who do the surgeries really do not want to see any joint get infected. The issue of with regards to the dentist saying 2 years only, again, it's based on their experience with treating people with certain conditions, but I don't know if there's going to be any agreement amongst them. So I don't know what's magical about the 2 years. 2 years is usually a good time for everything to heal up, but the joint is still in place. I remember looking this up a while ago, and I'm just trying to bring it up now because, let me just do this right here, antibiotic prophylaxis for dental procedures. And they say for prevention of prosthetic joint infections. And so their summary and recommendations are Yeah, prevention of joint infections is important because of the difficulty of treating them. They say not for immunocompromised with history of joint infections more than they're saying that what your dentist said. We suggest not administering antibiotic prophylaxis prior to dental procedures for people who have normal immune systems with a history of a joint replacement more than two years. The problem is that the level of evidence is what we call they're citing is what they say is grade 2C, and grade 2C is a weak recommendation. It means it's a suggestion, and there isn't a lot of evidence to support it. It comes from mainly observational studies, meaning looking at people, looking at infection rates, but not really doing a blinded study where you give, you know, if you do the dental procedures and you give half those people an antibiotic and the other half no antibiotic, and then look and see what happens over time. Those studies have not been done. So that's the problem with it. The evidence is not that great. The recommendations are based on that level of evidence. And really, if you have no allergies, I would say in this case, because the evidence is not that strong, that you probably should take the prophylaxis as opposed to not taking it, because it's one dose. It's usually 2 grams of ampicillin or amoxil, one dose. If you have no penicillin allergies, that one dose will not do you harm, and it will protect you from any potential infection.
Okay, and is this just for cleaning, or is it for any dental procedure?
Usually, if they're going to cut the skin, if there's major dental procedures, yes. I mean, I have a knee replacement as well, partial knee replacement. When I go to the dentist and I go for cleanings, I don't take prophylaxis. It's only, for example, if you have molars removed or there has to be some significant cutting through the gums or drilling through the teeth, that kind of thing, where there's a risk of really going deep into the gum and releasing bacteria into the bloodstream, that's when you would usually take the prophylaxis.
Okay, well, thank you very much. That was very helpful.
You're very welcome, Beverly.
Bye.
Bye-bye now. 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long-distance number. Let's go to line 3 and Duncan in Ottawa. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Dr. Dworkin. I didn't see the aforementioned article in the Globe and Mail. I'm totally blind, no pun intended.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But, you know, judging from what you read, I disagree with this strongly. It's not for the airlines industry to punish passengers.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not excusing obesity, but some people, you know, can't help how they are. As you say, in some cases, it's a genetic thing. There's too much stone throwing these days.
Mm-hmm.
You might as well. It's like, you know, you might as well pass judgment and everything. We disapprove of other people. I mean, I've traveled on buses with people who smell unwashed,
mm-hmm.
and I don't mean to, you know, I don't mean to sound graphic,
right.
But nobody kicks them off the bus,
right. And you know, again, you have people who have joint injuries or they've got osteoarthritis and they're not able to walk and be as active, and that can contribute to weight gain as well. So are we going to punish them because of another medical condition that led to their weight gain, and then have, you know, in this case, airlines say, well, you weigh more, so you need to pay more. you know, playing devil's advocate, the airline is simply saying that we're going to charge everyone by weight. So say you take a lot of luggage with you, you pay more. If you weigh less, you'll pay less. And it's one airline that's done that. And again, I think their view is not to discriminate per se against people that weigh more. They are simply saying that it costs us more if the plane weighs more in terms of the lift and taking off and the fuel being used. But the question is this the right way to go about that? Do you just raise the rates for everybody to cover the cost over an average? Or do you single out one group and say that they're the ones that are going to share that particular burden?
Oh, you're, I mean, you're sacrificing services for the same reason, you know, supposedly cut costs. It just means fewer people will fly if everybody takes that attitude.
Right. Well, Duncan, I'd like to thank you for your opinion today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye now. And we're going to take a small break. And when we come back, we have Mary in Ottawa who'd like to talk about weight and genetics. And Sean in Ottawa would like to talk about taking up jogging. We have still lots of lines available. 521-TALK, 521-8255. Star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call. And we'll be back in just a few minutes after the news.
The advice and recommendations in this program are for general educational purposes and not a diagnosis. You should consult a physician or health professional directly before beginning or changing any course of health treatment.
Never know how much I love you. Never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a fever that's so hard to bear. You give me fever when you kiss me, fever when you hold me tight. Fever in the morning, fever all through the night.
521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. And we're going to go to line two and say good afternoon to Mary in Ottawa.
Hello, Dr. Dworkin.
Hi.
I am on Lipitor.
Yes.
And generic type.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to weigh 176 pounds. Now I weigh 135. Would that make any difference, but with taking the Lipitor? And I've had both my knees replaced.
Right. There shouldn't be any difference. Usually, with regards to, it's a good question, Mary, because there are certainly some medications that are dosed according to weight.
My knees ache like crazy, and if I cut my Lipitor in half,
mm-hmm.
they don't ache.
Well, it's, you know, this is something, if we're making the assumption that Lipitor is causing pain,
uh-huh.
it usually doesn't cause joint pain. It'll cause muscle aches, so the calf muscle or the thigh muscles would cause some pain. But the knees themselves, especially since if you've had knee replacements, there's nowhere for the Lipitor to act on. They're artificial surfaces, so the
yeah.
Lipitor wouldn't do much there.
So it would be the muscle that would be aching.
If it was muscle, though, it wouldn't be in the knee itself. It would be either above or below the knee. So when you're having those pains, is it in the calf or in the thigh, or is it in the knee joint itself?
How about the whole leg?
It's the whole leg?
The whole leg, yeah.
Yeah, so then what you may want to do, it's a reasonable discussion to have with your physician, especially if you've noticed that if you cut it in half, you feel better.
I do. I feel it was just like getting new legs.
Right.
I tried it for 3 days, and I thought I better not do this for too long because...
Okay, and then when you started up again, it started
to hurt
again. I
started up again, the pain came back again.
Yeah, so you know, that's actually a good way to find out, because there's certainly no harm in short-term, you know, in the short term to stop a statin like Lipitor to see what happens. So what I would suggest is to speak with your physician, because if you cut it in half and you found that it wasn't causing any pain anymore, the next step would be to say, okay, you know, a physician would say, okay, well, cut it in half and let's check your cholesterol levels 3 months from now.
That's why I'm calling
yeah.
you today, is I go to see my doctor on the 22nd and I want to have something to tell him.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, what you've told me, it's perfectly reasonable. I mean, you've done literally an experiment that showed, in this case, cause and effect, that you felt better when you... And you didn't stop the medication completely.
No, I didn't
stop
it. I just
cut it in half.
One.
Yeah.
Now I'm taking a half one and a whole one, a half one one night and
yeah.
a whole one the next night sort of thing. That's until I go to see him.
Okay.
And,
so I would bring that up. And again, reducing the use of a statin for 3 months is not going to have a significant impact on your risk of heart disease or heart attack.
I'm on standby with heart attack, or you know,
right?
I'm 87.
Yeah, but again,
and
to take those medications, and if it's the medication that's giving you all that pain, that interferes with quality of life as well. And we may not, you know, it may be a good way to find out if you cut it in half, If your cholesterol level stays at the target or the goal that's necessary for you,
okay.
then
it's okay.
It's okay. You know, if the level has gone up, the question that you have to then ask yourself and also speak to your physician about in terms of discussing this issue, because it is important, because at 87, you know, what we look at is measures of quality of life versus the treatment itself. And if the treatment is impacting severely on someone's quality of life, where they're having pain all the time.
Well, I'm a walker, so.
Yeah, that's it. And if you're not able to walk, you know, you have to then say, okay, what is the risk to me by reducing the Lipitor in half and being able to walk all the time versus the taking Lipitor all the time and not being able to walk at all?
Well, it's just so painful at times. It's even hard to get up in the morning out of bed.
Right. And so that has value in terms of determining what the best course of action is going to be. You know, in an ideal world or ideal situation, you know, you'd say, okay, take the medication, because we know that the medication over time will reduce your risk of heart attack and stroke. But at the same time, it's not as clear cut as that, because you can't walk.
That's right.
You have the pain.
And I've been on this pill. I can't remember how long I've been on it, but I don't even remember who gave it to me. So I thought, well, it's time I checked it out, because
I think that's a great idea, Mary.
Very painful, and I'm old, but I'm not old.
Well, no, I hear what you're saying, and you know, the quality of life issue becomes much more important as someone gets older, because let's face it, you know, and I'm not trying to be crude or blunt or anything,
but
you know, at age 87, you know, we have to ask, what is the likelihood that you will be here in 10 years?
I shouldn't be here now, so I've only had 22 operations.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
So you know, you look at a person's 10-year survival based on their age, and that's not unreasonable, right?
No, because, that's true.
Because you don't want to do things to people. You know, it's be different if someone was 40 years old.
Yeah.
Then you would say, okay, you have to take this, this, and this, because you have another 50, 60 years potentially to live.
Well, I know I don't.
And if you're 87... you then have to say, okay, are we going to treat you but make you miserable for the rest of your life?
Yeah.
Or are we going to try to tailor the treatment so that you get the most enjoyment out of your life as possible?
Mm-hmm.
And so those are very important questions that that need to be discussed, especially as people get older, because some people will say, you know, hey, you know, doc, it's not worth it to me to be taking this because I can't do what I want to do, and I have only X number of years left in my life, and I want to enjoy them. And I'm willing to take the risk of something, you know, if I have a heart attack, I'm willing to take the risk if it means I can live my life and not be pain-free.
Is there any danger of strokes with taking Lipitor?
Taking Lipitor and having stroke, no.
No.
Because Lipitor will help reduce the risk of stroke in some cases. But, I mean, it's primarily taken to reduce your risk of heart attack, right?
But I've already had a stroke, eh?
Yeah. But usually there are other medications that are used to help reduce that risk of stroke.
Yeah.
Again, it's not a clear cut situation. That's why you have to have this discussion with your physician,
with my doctor,
because you have other conditions that need to be put into the mix.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, though, it's your decision to determine what level of risk you're willing to deal with. With regards to medication use or not taking medication or reducing Lipitor or remaining at that dose, you know, they may want to change the medication to something different, which may not have as much side effects. So there are always different approaches to things. But I think it is important, especially since you enjoy walking, that you have that opportunity to do so without pain.
Yeah, well, I tried it for 3 days and it did. I mean, my legs didn't feel like my own legs. They felt like somebody else's, really.
Well,
they were light, and they were the way that when I go out now, they weigh like if they weigh a ton.
Yeah, and I think that is a very important point to bring up with your physician. So I hope that discussion you have with your physician works out for you.
I hope so too.
All right.
Thank you very much, Dr. Worker.
You're very welcome.
Nice talking to you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. 521 Talk, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility. 1-800-580-2372 is our long-distance number. And we're going to line one. And Sean in Ottawa, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm kind of halfway in between there.
Okay.
I'm 61, And I was thinking of, I did a long walk today for about an hour and a half, all the way from Bayview, O-Train station, to downtown and back.
Wow.
And I also walked from Blossom Park to the O-Train station and back. But I'm gearing up for a, possibly looking into running as a cardiovascular a substitute, not a substitute, but because I'm a fairly moderate eater,
right?
I want to try and change my lifestyle. My bicycle, unfortunately, I cracked the handlebars, so I can't use it for a while. So I'm either going to have to fix the bicycle or buy a good pair of sneakers. Now, is running something that you can take? My doctor runs, and he's in his mid-50s.
Yeah.
And he doesn't seem to have a problem, but I thought I would check up.
Well, yeah, I mean, if we make several assumptions, one is that your health is good, that you have, you know, that in terms of heart disease risk or high blood pressure, that those things have been taken care of.
Right.
Do you have any underlying illnesses at all?
Well, I've been tested for a loop monitor.
Okay.
Last year. Now, I sent the results back. But I only had two incidents, but I had way more incidents on or about my retirement, which is at age 60.
Mm-hmm.
And I seem to have more of them in the winter. But by the time I got the loop monitored, it was May.
Okay.
And I only had two incidents. So I haven't actually been back to see my family doctor.
Okay.
And I haven't had a cholesterol test either.
Okay. So when someone is thinking of starting up a new activity. And for jogging is not as, you know, it's not as if you're running flat out. You're trying to, you're trying to keep a certain pace. So you know, you have to make sure, you know, does someone have any joint problems? Do they have any osteoarthritis or is there anything that could make that worse?
Right.
So there's that aspect. With regards to cardiac status, it's very important to know that you are not increasing your risk of heart attack or angina by starting up that. So, or inducing any arrhythmias. If you had a loop monitor, you had an irregular heartbeat or something.
That's,
right?
That's what happened. Yeah. I had it almost felt like the heart muscle was kind of shivering.
Right. So you may want to have a sports, almost like a sports medicine cardiology consult.
Okay.
So you can speak to your family doctor and get clearance from a cardiologist who will do the necessary evaluation to ensure that you're not putting yourself at risk.
Okay.
Again, because if you've had a loop monitor and you've already had these little things, it wouldn't be, it's not necessarily the best thing just to go out and start running without knowing if that running or jogging is going to exacerbate an irregular heartbeat.
They have a sports medicine doctor, Johnson, at Carleton University.
Well, there's a difference between sports medicine and having a cardiologist take a look at you.
Oh,
what
I
the cardiologist
see.
May
okay.
do is put you on a treadmill and watch and see what happens, and it's under controlled conditions. So I would have your family doctor, you know, make a referral if they thought it was necessary to make a referral to a cardiologist with a specific question saying, you know, this patient, 61-year-old, has had a a query irregular heart rhythm and is thinking about taking up jogging.
Right.
Are there any contraindications to doing so? And then they will answer that question back based on any evaluation that they do.
Is that like a stress test or something?
They might do a stress test. They can do other monitors, Holter monitors. There's a bunch of stuff that they can do for to make a thorough evaluation, but at least you then have that information to make a decision. As opposed to just starting up something and hoping that things don't happen. But, you know, when you're dealing with the heart, you don't just want to hope nothing happens.
Well,
you want to make sure nothing happens.
My father had a heart attack in his 60s.
Yeah.
And he didn't have another one. It was minor, but he lived to be 89.
Right.
So my genes are good. It's just a question.
Yeah, and I think taking up exercise is a great idea. You know, and so whatever you enjoy in terms of activity, absolutely, but again, because of your age and because of some of the other issues, it's just worthwhile to make sure to get cleared ahead of time before you take up the activity and go whole hog into it, because you may end up, unfortunately, with a nasty surprise.
Okay, thanks very much, Doctor.
You're very welcome, Sean.
All right.
All the best.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye now. And we're going to take a small break for some messages. And when we come back, we have Joanne and Greeley and Fran and Nepean. And someone else is calling in too. So we're going to take a small break. You're listening to Sunday House Call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. Back in a couple of minutes.
Dr. Scholl makes foot products. And he's a doctor, so he went to school for a long time. But it doesn't take a lot to figure out that stepping on a cushion will be more comfortable.
One trainer put me on the no-carb, the Atkins. They said after a week you won't have any carb cravings. I felt lied to. I had cravings. When you drive by a bakery and you jump out of a moving vehicle, that's a craving.
Liability waiver.
Don't read it, just sign it. It simply says you won't hold us responsible if you die as a result of gross negligence. It's a standard form.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA.
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of fears without crying. Now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you can.
And right back to the phone lines. And good afternoon to Joanne and Greeley.
Hi there.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
Good, thank you. I have a little concern of mine. I'm not sure if I should go see my physician or not, but my nail bed seems to have split from the bottom up, and it's somewhat, I guess, infected slightly. Has a little bit of pain, and sometimes the nail, the thumb, it's in my thumb, goes stiff. So other times it just feels like it's getting better.
Okay. So is it the skin or is it the nail that is...
The nail has split completely.
The nail is split. Okay. Yeah. But the cuticle that surrounds the nail, is it red or is it just a normal appearance?
No, it's red. It almost looks like it's got a wart effect.
Okay. So it's a bit swollen as well.
Yes.
Okay. So the most common type of infection that we see of the cuticle is something called a paronychia. And that's where bacteria get under the or into the skin. And it swells up, it gets red. Sometimes you get pus that comes out of the area. Other times it can just swell up and get and look really red. The reason the nail may split is because if it's red right at the bottom, right at the bottom part of the cuticle.
Right at the bottom part and almost halfway up my nail.
Okay. So what tends to happen is that when you get an infection in that area, you actually damage the nail bed from which new nail grows. And if that's the case, the nail will split because it's not growing properly. The normal construction of that nail gets damaged and literally it falls apart.
Mm-hmm.
But the treatment is actually to treat the cuticle and to get rid of the infection. And so you may want to just have this looked at to confirm the diagnosis because obviously I can't see this over the phone.
Right.
But the normal approach to treating paronychia is to soak this in extremely is a relative term, but as hot water as you can stand, not to the point of scalding your finger, but really hot.
Okay.
The reason is that that heat will kill the bacteria that's in that area of the skin because the bacteria cannot survive at that temperature. And you do that for about 20 minutes, three times a day. There is also there's also a topical antibiotic that can be used, mupirocin, or the brand name is called Bactroban. There's also something called fusidic acid or Fusidin that can be applied to the surface of the skin because it penetrates into the skin and can help heal that up. But it's actually the hot soaks that do the most to cure that.
Okay.
So those are, I mean, there's certainly no harm in soaking that in hot water, again, three times a day for 20 minutes until you see your physician. You may find that by the time you do that, and you do that for at least two or three days because you really want to try to kill off that infection.
Okay.
Polysporin doesn't work very well,
no.
So I wouldn't use that at all.
I know I have some Bactroban, and I have been using that, so but not consistent, and that's probably where the problem lies.
Yeah, and you have to use the hot soaks, because, again, that heat will literally kill off that bacteria. Because it's just at a fingertip, the heat will penetrate very well. It's at an extremity, so that the temperature can be well controlled, and it is quite effective.
Okay, excellent.
All right.
All right, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. And we have time for one more caller, and it is Fran in Nepean, who's been waiting quite patiently. Good afternoon, Fran.
Good afternoon. I've got what's called a severe calcification of the coronary arteries.
Yes.
never had any symptoms of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
I was found just by accident by having a chest x-ray for my lungs.
Mm-hmm.
I'm taking something for high blood pressure and something for, what do you call it?
Hey, Maren, we only have about a minute left, so you may want to get to your question.
My question is, I want to lose weight, and I'm just worrying if going on a severe diet is going to bother my heart. It hasn't before. I've done this before. But every time he says, well, if you have a cardiac incident, mm-hmm. You get to the Heart Institute as fast as you can.
Right. Well, there's losing weight should be a gradual thing and not to try and lose 10 or 20 pounds in a month or two. That's actually quite hard on your body to do that. And also can increase the risk, usually when you see rapid weight loss, can increase the risk of gallstones and getting a painful gallbladder from that kind of weight loss. So usually gradual weight loss is encouraged for people who are overweight or who need to lose weight to reduce the risk of heart disease and heart attack and reduce their blood pressure. But I can't advise you to say that, I can't tell you that it's safe to lose a lot of weight all at once.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye now. My apologies to Kathy in Ottawa, who wanted to talk about tarsal tunnel syndrome, and Maren in Ottawa about an ankle joint injury. I'll be on with Rob this Wednesday and back here again next Sunday. My thanks to Dave Tripp for producing Sunday House Call. You're listening to Sunday House Call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. Have a great week.